On Tuesday, the 13th of March, between 10 and 11 in the evening, while I was examining the small stars in the neighborhood of H. Geminorum and the small star in the quartile between Auriga and Gemini, and finding it so much larger than either of them, suspected it to be a comet. William Herschel was a composer. He composed, among other things, the music we're hearing now, before he focused on astronomy. And in 1781, he was the first person in history to discover a planet. He and his sister Caroline went on to make such important discoveries that they have been called the inventors of modern astronomy. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The lives and accomplishments of William and Caroline Herschel have been recreated in a play by Chiori Miyagawa. And here to give us a picture of the man and the woman behind that play are three guests, UW astronomer Jim Lattice, harpsichordist John Chapel Stowe, who performs the music of William Herschel, and Miranda McLennigan, who recently directed the play Comet Hunter.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great to be here.
What a fascinating couple this is, William and his sister Caroline Herschel. Can you tell us something about the lives, the early lives of these two?
Well, William was born in 1738, an interesting time to be born in the middle of Germany, Hanover, he was from, a time when most young people were exposed to music, and William was no exception. He learned to play the violin, the oboe, the harpsichord, and the organ, and remained a practitioner of those instruments for certainly the first half of his life until he went on to other things, to pursue other interests. As he was growing up, he joined the Hanover Guard and was active as a soldier, ended up in England as the Hanover Guard was dispatched there, but eventually his father managed to get him out of the army. But William really wanted to return to England, as he'd had such a grand time. So he went back to England with his brother Jacob in 1756, I believe it was, and pursued a career, first as a music copyist, then landed a job based on his oboe playing, landed a job as an oboist and conductor, and then was, for the next 10 years or so, was very active in musical circles in the area of Halifax, Leeds, and Bath.
What about his science? Yeah. I mean, that gives us his music. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What about that science connection?
Well, he was becoming interested in science after he was established in Bath. He got the position of the organist at Bath, which was a position that required composition and performance mm-hmm. both, and seems to have started to get interested in science as a, really as a pastime, would stay up late reading a wide variety of both philosophical, he was fond of Kant, for example, philosophical works, but also scientific texts of the periods. Ferguson's Astronomy was apparently influential for him. And apparently he used to, after a long day of composing or playing, he would retire with a bowl of milk to bed along with an astronomy book. And
the Milky Way.
That's right. So he was really self-educated in that. And that area, teaching himself fairly advanced astronomy and mathematics.
What was known about the universe in 1760, 1770? What were the general opinions that would have been held in London astronomical circles?
Well, by that period of time, no astronomers seriously took, for example, took the geocentric theory at all, Newtonian mechanics and the general heliocentric view of the solar system that we have today would have been an assumption of theirs. But there was a great deal of mystery about the stellar universe. What did the distribution of stars in the sky, what was that telling us, the Milky Way, as you mentioned? Why do we look in some directions and see lots more stars than we do when we look in other directions? And what does it mean that some are brighter than others? And what can we learn from pairs of stars, from binary star systems, which was one of the specialties that Herschel originally began researching. So that more distant universe was a huge question. The the distances and the arrangements of the stars, and became a question that Herschel spent much of his life on, trying to determine the shape of what we would think of really as the galaxy, but what they thought of as the universe.
What about those planets, though? What was known of them?
The most distant planet known at that time was Saturn, which had been known since antiquity. You can see that with the unaided eye. And so we don't know when the first people distinguished them from the stars. And in the period in which Herschel was first working, not even the asteroids were known. So strictly the planets that we think of out to Saturn and the moons of those planets, and really only a handful of only the biggest and brightest of those were known.
And let's see, Galileo had seen the rings of Saturn, although the planet was known, but that's back of 1609 or so.
Well, yeah. Galileo saw what proved to be the rings of Saturn, although he didn't know how to interpret them, and it was Christian Huygens sometime later who was able to explain their kind of mysterious appearance by hypothesizing a ring system. And, of course, Galileo had discovered the bright moons of Jupiter, what we call the Galilean moons of Jupiter. But it was still a big deal to discover a new satellite of a planet. What people just yawn these days when we find the 67th moon of Jupiter or something along that line, but it was a big deal to find a new moon of a planet. And certainly it was a very big deal when Herschel came upon that thing that, as you read at the opening there, that he tentatively identified as a comet, but recognized pretty quickly that it was probably something other than a comet, and voiced his suspicions, at least to a few close correspondents, that maybe there was really something else going on there. And that, of course, proved to be the planet Uranus.
Now, the play, The Comet Hunter, is mostly centered on the sister, Caroline, mm-hmm. right? Miranda, when you directed this play, what struck you about her story that made it a good source for dramatic material?
Well, I think what is really interesting about the story is told through the production, through the theater piece, is her relationship with her brother and how dedicated and committed she is to his success. In fact, at one point in the play, she is offered a position as a soloist, as a singer, and she turns it down and saying that, no, she is there dedicated and committed to his work. And it's quite interesting how the passions of both of these characters, as well in real life, but as it's played out in the script, the passion of both of these people and the way they pursue that passion, it almost as if they stumble across amazing success in both things that they do, music and comet hunting, stargazing. If only all of us had 5% of their talent. But it's very interesting how they were so successful as well as talented and well thought of in their fields, but at the same time somewhat stumbled into these things, incredibly committed to these things. But, you know, as I mentioned, her success, she backed off of as far as music went and as far as singing goes. And, you know, he talks about how, oh, if I didn't have to deal with this music, I could. It's just, it amazes me, the incredible talent of both of these characters. And then she as an individual, her incredible strength against so many life-given odds, being sick as a child and being considered by her, through her upbringing, is the fact that, you know, the expectation held for her was so, in those days it was very common, but nowadays, you know, by today's standard, is so minimal. I mean, they just expected her to darn the socks. And what she ended up accomplishing is just amazing. And her strength in those accomplishments and her resolve, her quiet power as who she was and what she was committed to is just, you know, you listen to the lines from her and you just think, wow, if only everyone could have a sister like that.
Do you have a sample of her voice in the play?
I sure do. Early on, Caroline is talking about her upbringing and how she was thought of by her parents. And she says, my father was a good man. He wanted to give me an education, but mother was always absolutely against it. And he was too gentle to defy her wishes. He used to steal a little time on Dietrich's violin for me. Some evenings when his pupils gathered for a concert, he would call me to the parlor and say, Lena, play the second violin for us. And I would play as he conducted the small orchestra. He taught me how to read and write. And William, oh, I adored him as a little girl. He is most like my father out of all the brothers and only person left who calls me Lena. I remember when I was 7... William took me out of the house on one frosty night into the streets, and we stood and watched the constellations. Mother wasn't happy because she thought the night air was bad for our constitutions. William ignored her, and we stayed out a good half hour holding hands, looking up at the heavens. He left for England the next day. While time moves forward and William leaves and becomes a very accomplished composer, I stand still and Father dies. I continue to stand still.
What did they do to support themselves? Did they use the music to support the astronomical habit, or how did they get by?
Can you imagine using the arts as a way of making money?
Yeah, but I mean, can you imagine using astronomy in 18th century England as another way?
Well, William was remarkable in that, in finding himself this position in Bath, mm-hmm. which was at least a comfortable and steady employment, which probably isn't unusual enough for a musician in that period.
He was the organist of the Octagon Chapel, a rather well-known place in Bath, and also had responsibility for directing community music series in Bath, which already in the early 1760s involved resurrecting the memory of Handel's music. He was very involved
sure,
in
Handel
the,
had just
in
died.
The, right. He was very involved in the perpetuation of Handel's mystique in England. So this was a way to make a living. There was a huge following for these community concerts, choral and orchestra concerts that he directed and produced.
He probably gave private lessons as well. Mm-hmm. So he would have had an adequate income, as I'm sure many would have been. But the remarkable thing is Herschel is sometimes called the first professional astronomer because of his transition from music into astronomy after the discovery of Uranus. The king offered him a pension, that is to say a salary, in order to serve as the royal astronomer, not the astronomer royal, who would have been the fellow working down there at Greenwich, but the royal astronomer, the one who comes at the beck and call of the king. And so at that point, he's able to devote himself to what had been this hobby and become the professional astronomer that by then he had aspired to be.
That kind of career change is unusual, where you actually go pretty much entirely from one to the other, and they're very different occupations.
But did he see a link? In other words, in his music, when he was composing, did it reflect his concept of, you know, the music of the spheres or the ordered universe? Do you see a link?
Well, it is interesting. Still in the 18th century, despite the general acceptance of the heliocentric universe, Galileo was no longer a heretic, at least in the eyes of people in Germany and England. The connection between musica mundana, that harmony of the spheres, and musica humana, the part of human behavior that is influenced by the heavenly bodies, that link is still very much alive in the popular culture. So I have no doubt that William and Caroline saw a direct relationship between what they saw in the sky and the direction that their lives were taking.
Did they have to be mathematicians to pull off astronomy the way they did it?
Yes, especially the way they did it, because Herschel was unusual, partly because of his amateur status, but was unusual in the type of instruments that he decided to use. He started using a reflecting telescope, one that requires a mirror, like had been invented by Isaac Newton, but were rarely used by astronomers in that period, whose primary task, as they saw it, was to measure accurately the positions of objects in the sky in order to determine, for example, orbits of objects, but also to provide a very precise picture, a very precise catalog of the stars that would allow you to do things like timekeeping and that sort of thing to a very high degree of accuracy. But measuring positions among the stars requires, at that level of accuracy, requires special kinds of instruments that have fancy, expensive graduated scales and things like that. And they don't demand a great deal in the way of what astronomers call light gathering power, the ability to see dim objects. They didn't particularly care about that. Herschel starts building reflecting telescopes, which he can make himself and don't have the fancy machinery that the professional telescopes would have. He starts using these telescopes to sweep the sky. In order to calculate a position on the sky from one of those, you have to do very careful observations of nearby stars, and then there's a good bit of math required before you put them into the coordinate system that the catalogs contain. So a lot of the observing they would do, in fact, Caroline was key to this, because she would put in the effort of doing these coordinate conversions, which is a good bit of trigonometry. Every time they would observe the position of a star, in order to compare it to the catalog, they would have to do a coordinate conversion into the coordinate systems used in the catalogs.
How did they learn that stuff? Who were their mentors?
Especially Caroline, at a time when women weren't generally sent to school.
Well, wasn't William her mentor?
Well, exactly. Where did he pick it up, though?
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, well, there you go.
Well, right. And I think that's what he was doing in his spare time, as the leisure that being a successful musician provided him, allowed him to teach himself. He was just amazing. He would seek out these texts, borrow them from friends. It was quickly after he arrived in Bath, became part of the local philosophical society and established contacts with other learned people. So he had access to books and journals and things like that. And he was an autodidact, I think, in all these areas. He taught himself the physics and astronomy.
The passage you read, Miranda, where Caroline is talking about how she's standing still, you sort of pick up a note of resentment a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
I'm wondering to what extent William used Caroline and to what extent he gave her full credit and full involvement in the work she was doing.
In the play, it's very, in a way, you can look at the scene of when William comes to their mother and says, I need her to come live with me. And he uses the argument with his mother, I need her to help keep the house and keep my books. But you get the feeling that subtextually he's saying, you are better than this. You are more than this, and you have a mind that is stronger than this. Of course, that's the way I chose to view it. But I do think that he used the conventions of the day in order to, I think, yes, have an assistant, which he actually she became his assistant and received an annual stipend when he became the royal
astronomer.
But really, you know, she was of such value to him and such support. You know, and you see that as it goes through the play when William and his wife Mary have a son and Caroline becomes a confidant to the son as well and somewhat assists in raising the son and nurturing his love of the stars. And so it's an interesting relationship between the two of them. And yes, the conventions of the day would definitely suggest that it would be a less supportive relationship between the two. But I do think that he saves her from a very different existence than she ended up having and changing the course of women being viewed, or at least started that change.
Well, and as you say, the conventions have a lot to do with it. She was by default his housekeeper when she came to live with him in England, and he expected her to keep the household accounts and to see to the hiring and management of household help and things like that. But she was a full partner in his astronomical work and then soon came up with projects of her own. She engaged in her own program of sweeping the heavens for comets. She discovered, I think, four comets and confirmations of a good many other ones. And these were things that she was doing on her own, not to mention then the catalog work and essentially the daytime sort of work that he depended on her to complete as well.
Let's find out exactly how they did work together, William Herschel and his sister Caroline, in their explorations of the heavens when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. It's from an oboe concerto by William Herschel, who in his 30s made a transition, a radical career transition from professional musician and composer to professional astronomer and went on with his sister Caroline to become the inventors of modern astronomy. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guests for this hour, as we delve into the careers of William and Caroline Herschel, our guests are Jim Lattice, astronomer, harpsichordist John Chapel Stowe, and Miranda McLennigan, who recently directed the play Comet Hunter about William and Caroline Herschel. Before we get into their partnership as astronomers, more about their partnership as musicians.
Well, in William's capacity as organist at the Octagon Chapel in Bath, for instance, Caroline, a very, very talented singer, was a valuable part of the choir. And not only that, but no doubt served as a soloist, performed as a soloist in performances of Handel's music in the community concerts that William directed. In the play, Comet Hunter, there is an account of Caroline's being offered a singing position, a role to sing in London, apart from William's direction. And she turned it down because it would not have involved William's presence.
I think we even have a letter from her to that effect. I mean, a historical document.
Right. And she didn't want to do that. So there, her sense of collaboration with him was very close. She didn't really want to make music if William wasn't around. Very interesting.
I think even at the sort of mundane level of making copies of scores and things like that, I believe Caroline was rather busy. He was obviously composing things for the chapel's programs, but parts would have to be copied out for this instrument or the
other. Right. And copying music was an important source of income for anyone who had musical knowledge.
Constant market for it.
That's right. That's right. You could make a fair amount of money. I wouldn't say a lot, but a fair amount of money from offering yourself as a music copyist. More people than we know supported themselves that way.
Well, you know, and now that I think of it, a good, accurate music copyist could make a transition into a good, accurate cataloger of astronomical data. I mean, they both require a lot of minute attention to detail.
A lot of patience, right. I would think. Mm-hmm. How did the two of them work together on the science on a daily basis? They got up and did what?
Well, for a good bit of their work, it was not like the discovery of Uranus, where he would have been examining stars in the sky and noting, and particularly he was looking for double stars, but he saw this kind of unusual one that had a disk rather than being point-like a star. But a good bit of their work was extremely routine. They worked their way through Flamsteed's star catalog, for example, star by star, observing in the sky and looking at the neighboring stars.
You just say, what, found that one? Let's go on to the next one?
Right. More or less. They would pick up one. You have to get one right to begin with. And then Herschel would watch as the Earth rotates, the telescope goes with it, and the star field drifts through the eyepiece. He looks in the eyepiece, and he knows the field, the number of degrees on either side of the center of the field. And new stars would come into the field. And he would mention that, okay, I've got a dim one about fourth magnitude, kind of yellowish, and she would be looking at Flamsteed's catalog. Oh, that's Flamsteed, you know, 257 or something. And then occasionally there would be one that Flamsteed had missed or where there was a mistake in Flamsteed. And they went through the whole catalog, marking it up, finding omitted stars and mistakes and things like that. And then one of the things that Caroline did was do almost a new edition, although I don't think it was published as such, but a new edition of Flamsteed's catalog, integrating what Flamsteed had published, which was not published in an optimal way for observing, and they were very interested in that, and also integrating all these corrections and additions that they had found.
Of course, it's easy for us to assume that the skies were perfectly clear every night, but we're talking about England. We're talking about near one of the largest cities in the world, which is basically warmed by coal. And they must have had to have a lot of patience when those clouds came in or the fog came in or the rain to just have to break off and start over again the next night or the next night or the next night.
Well, they had plenty of time to do those calculations, the data reduction.
And were they collaborating with people elsewhere in Europe? I mean, were they just working in isolation?
At first, yes. Herschel was sort of a peripheral member of a couple of philosophical societies and would write letters to prominent astronomers asking their advice on one thing or another, but was pretty much unknown at the time when he discovered Uranus in 1781. That, of course, made him immediately the toast of England. In fact, quite quickly he became internationally famous. There were requests from monarchs, for example, to have a telescope just like the one that he used to discover Uranus with. And he actually made a little bit of money building these instruments now astronomical instruments, for export.
Now, how much of that export market, especially for royalty or nobility, how much of it was vanity and how much of it were they really interested in science and new discoveries?
Ooh. I mean, one has to guess that there's a lot of vanity. I don't know what the King of Spain is going to do with a replica of Herschel's telescope. Not discover more planets.
To some extent, I mean, you mentioned earlier, Jim, that to some extent these discoveries and calculations were good for, say, navigational fixes. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the British Navy being the biggest in the world at this time and, you know, extending the empire around the globe would have good use for some of this data, but a lot of it sounds as if it was just, well, he's got a telescope, I want one.
His purposes were not primarily those of the astronomer royal, of the Navy's needs. And they had their own agenda, which was very different from Herschel's. The great thing for Herschel was that this pension from the king allowed him to pursue his own research interests, except when the king wanted to come over and look through the telescope or send some of his guests over. And this actually becomes kind of a burden for Herschel. He wishes that he wasn't quite so close to the king's residence.
That's why there were the term a royal pain comes from.
Right, because they would have to entertain the king's house guests or whatever. My astronomer can show you. It's a great night. We can send you over there. He can show you his new planet or something. But this was a bit of an impediment, of course, to his work. But except for that impediment, he could follow his research program where he wanted to go, which was ultimately in trying to understand the structure of the universe, what we would think of as the galaxy.
And in the play, Comet Hunter, how does the playwright show the brother-sister working or collaborating? I would think it would be difficult to make a lot of drama out of two people doing calculations and waiting for the sky to clear.
You know, it's interesting. The playwright adds in some details that whether or not these events or these thoughts were ever occurring, you don't know. But there's an interesting passage when Mary is introduced, William's wife, and Caroline's response to her is very interesting. There's an understanding of Mary and why Mary would be there. But, you know, after they get married and Caroline comes back to the house, she's very frustrated that the silverware has been moved. You know, she's almost a scorned, I don't want to say lover, but their partnership definitely was much more connected than I know my siblings and myself. But I think that the playwright really did explore some of those details of how they would have worked together and finished each other's sentences and that kind of thing. There's a great section in the play also when they are star sweeping or sky sweeping.
Right. They're about to look through this new telescope, the largest one at that time in the world that Herschel has just finished. And so the playwright sort of recreates that moment.
And time is a character in the play, is that right?
Yes. I think now I have not spoken with the playwright on this. And, you know, as a director, one can only assume. But I think time is a structured character, one, because Caroline is awfully lonely. And is very, she doesn't fit into the culture in which she is. And so she has embraced, and she questions herself within time. She constantly is asking this character time, how much more time do I have to gaze at the stars? What is my time? And so it just seems logical that there would be this character of time. And time serves as a narrator. Time serves as a storyteller in helping the audience to see somewhat more of an objective view of the events. But also time serves as a confidant to her. And at one point in the play, Caroline gets very angry with time and says, can't you just say it plain? And so it's the relationship between this character, this vague but incredibly detailed at the same time character of time is very precious, but you see how much Caroline needs that person in the concept of time, because that's a concept she struggles with, very much so.
So here's a scene from Comet Hunter, starting with the voice of time.
Rewind time to 1789. William erects a 40-foot telescope, which took the Herschels 4 years to build. August 28th, the world's largest telescope's first light.
William, say something.
Such brilliance. We have been near blind until now. Oh, Lena, the greatness of the heavens is unmistakable.
And you?
How strange is fate. Was I always meant to find this brightness? I was just an ordinary boy once.
You were never ordinary. There was always greatness to come.
Lena, I'm looking at Saturn.
Yes, I know. You have been wanting to see it closer.
My suspicion was right. The sixth moon of Saturn exists.
Are you certain that the sixth is not a star?
Its ranging is exact as with the other four moons and with the ring.
The retrograde motion should amount to nearly 4.5 minutes per day. So in about 2 hours, you should be able to ascertain if it's in fact a moon.
And will you stay up with me then?
Of course, William. I will always stay with you.
What an exciting night.
First light.
You are a great help, Lena.
That certainly proved true, too, in historical terms, didn't it?
Yes.
What can you tell us about the playwright, Chiori Miyagawa, and her reason for setting this particular part of the Herschel's life into a script?
My recollection is that there was an NSF, or maybe it was an NEH opportunity to write science-related plays, and Chiori was looking for a female scientist that she could write about. And I'm not sure how she settled on Caroline. Caroline wrote two autobiographies and kept extensive journals, many of which are preserved except for the ones that she herself destroyed shortly after the months right after
there.
William's, right after William's marriage. The journals are missing from, I forget, some months after that. So there was a lot to draw on, and Chiori, I think, started exploring these historical sources and was struck, as Miranda mentioned, and it's not original with Chiori, to observe that this relationship of Caroline and William is a remarkable one. The dedication to each other in the cause of this thing that they held in common, although it might be in sometimes in the play that's William who's the thing that they hold in common, and sometimes it's the science. But I think that's what got her interested in the play.
Where do the Herschels start to really, I'll say, break ground? That's not really quite the right metaphor.
Break sky.
So far, we've seen them basically as going through these pre-existing catalogs and correcting them and, you know, making all kinds of observations based upon them. But where do they really start finding things that are new?
Certainly with the discovery of Uranus in 1781.
Were they looking for a planet or were they looking for something else?
No, they were cataloging double stars. So they were basically surveying the sky for interesting double star pairs. And William comes across this object that doesn't look star-like. In a telescope that's in focus, a star is a point. Even in a very large telescope, a star is a point-like thing. An object, an extended object like a planet, will look like a disk. And so to an experienced observer, the distinction is immediately apparent. And he sees this, and the first thought to pretty much any experienced observer would be, this may be a comet. He didn't know of any comet that was currently in the sky, but here's a thing that shows a fuzzy disk. So his reaction that this might be a comet makes sense at first, although he clearly suspected something because a comet is fuzzier than a planet is. A planet has more sharply defined edges than a comet typically. So as he watched this over then some period of days, not only did its appearance seem a little bit different, but its motion was pretty much in the plane of the ecliptic, which is what the planets do. And comets typically don't restrain themselves to the plane of the ecliptic. And also its brightness wasn't changing a great deal, and comets will change radically in brightness over a fairly short period of time. So he recognized that he was dealing with something a little unfamiliar and began to think in terms of a planet, but he only announced that he had discovered an unusual comet at first and let others pretty much come to the conclusion that this was something more than that, an extension of the solar system, the first one to be discovered in history because Saturn, the next one in, was always known. So this was the first instance of a human being discovering a new planet in the solar system.
And I guess there's historically, to jump ahead with our friend Time here for just a minute, only one other instance of that because Neptune was, what, about 1830 or something like that? And then Pluto has been defrocked. So that's about it, right?
Well, 1846, is when Neptune was discovered. And Pluto was hailed as a great discovery. It's not so much that it's now been reclassified, but it turned out to be one of many out there in that part of the solar system. It was just a long gap between this discovery in 1930 and the discovery of its successors, which really picks up in the 1980s. Not its successors, it's accompanying small planets, small bodies out there. So major planets, that's right. Neptune is the only other one.
Things begin to happen for him as an astronomer. He has it pretty much made, but what does he go looking for then? Surely not another planet. He must have known that was going to be a very unusual find.
His primary preoccupation in later years is to survey the sky. He selects basically a strip of the sky that's perpendicular to the Milky Way and observes it with the intent of making essentially a census. He wants to count the number of stars per square degree in the sky, or the equivalent of that. And he and Caroline collaborate on this. This is laborious work because with this telescope, you look in the eyepiece, you wait for as always, with the Earth to turn the sky so that it passes through the field, and you count the stars and you time how long this has taken so you know what angle of sky you've crossed. And they literally count stars and work their way around the sky so that they do a cross-section through the Milky Way. Then, based on the assumption that the more stars you see in a given frame, the deeper the sky must be in that direction. That's why he's supposing we see more stars. He comes up with a measurement of the extent. He uses that then to judge the extent of the galaxy in those directions and comes up with a map of the galaxy showing how much farther it is in the direction of the Milky Way than it is at right angles to the Milky Way and quantitatively all the way around.
So he has a sense of the shape of it, in other words. Does he have a sense that it's a spiral or
no?
Not that far?
No, but he can talk about the distribution of the stars in the Milky Way and try to estimate its size and try to estimate the number of stars in really very rough numbers. But this is the first attempt by anyone to be so ambitious, to try and actually understand the structure of the universe on that kind of scale. The measurement is impossible pretty much in the way he did it. His instruments weren't up to that. You have to have an infrared telescope to do that kind of a measurement, which we only have now.
Did he have a sense that there were other galaxies?
The galaxies were referred to then as nebulae, and their nature was a complete mystery. Herschel had several ideas along the way. He was very interested in them. And there were times when he thought he had evidence that, in fact, they were clouds of stars. And there were other times when he thought that, in fact, they were clouds of some kind of nebulous matter, not stars, some gaseous or something like that, but not stars. And he never was entirely clear about that, went through several stages on that. But it was a question he was strongly interested in. But again, the answer to the question like that really wasn't – he didn't have the instruments he would have needed to answer that question.
We're going to look at the final days of William and Caroline Herschel, the music and the science, when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. From the Sonata for Cello and Harpsichord by William Herschel. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our guests are Miranda McLennigan, Jim Lattice, and John Chapel Stowe. We're talking about the lives, the science, and the music of William and Caroline Herschel. Let me ask you, John, about the harpsichord music we just heard and the music in general of William Herschel, because we've mostly been talking about his astronomy, but how does he rank as a musician?
Well, as a musician, Herschel was no doubt a very facile performer. The only thing we can really know, of course, is through his compositions and through anecdotal reports of his music making. His compositions reflect, well, probably the typical kind of music that would have been written by a good craftsman in the middle of the 18th century. Nothing terribly exciting to a person who is studying the development of music and individual voices. But then this was a time still when musicians were not concerned with being individuals so much. They saw themselves as craftspeople and not so much as individual voices like we begin to see in the 19th century. So I think his music was appreciated and enjoyed, but it certainly has not caused a ripple in the annals of music history. What is unusual about William Herschel, of course, is this double interest of his. And that double interest is also something that we see in Galileo, who was a very accomplished lutenist. It happens that Herschel came up in connection with this play in the same year when the Madison Early Music Festival this summer is planning a program that relates to the 400th anniversary of the invention of the telescope, which, of course, was vital to Galileo's career as an observationist and scientist. And so the presence of Herschel as an active musician and astronomer, Galileo as an active musician and astronomer, Galileo's father Vincenzo Galilei as not an astronomer but a scientist who is primarily a musician, all these things are very, very unusual to have combined in a single person. So we're excited to be able to explore Herschel's music as well as others who relate to our theme in the Early Music Festival this summer.
And we'll put a link to the Madison Early Music Festival website on our website at University mm-hmm. of the Air so that people can find information about if they want to hear the music of William Herschel, they can do so.
Do we have a sense of William Herschel and Caroline making music after they became astronomers? I mean, any indications that they just, you know, enjoyed playing music in the off hours or even in a larger community sense made music? Or Or does it kind of disappear from the record as soon as he becomes a professional astronomer?
I'm afraid I don't know of any discussions of composition or performance or
– I don't know any reference to music making after we begin to read about them as astronomers. So
it would make sense that they might keep it as a pastime,
yes.
I suppose.
Especially on cloudy days. You know?
After so many stars have been cataloged, it's time for something a little different, Caroline. Let's do something else. But it apparently was not nearly as big a part of his life, nor could have been,
the family tradition that went at least back to William's father, who was the accomplished musician, and his brothers were all musicians, certainly ends with his son, John Herschel, who became a famous astronomer but first studied law. I don't know of any hint that he ever seriously studied music either.
Did he actually find then comets? You mentioned, I think, some that they had found, maybe four that Caroline had helped to find. But was that a fairly easy thing to find, comets?
Oh, no. Well, some occasionally would be easy early on, but by then comet hunting was something that astronomers took very seriously and were eagerly searching for. So to find one before somebody else did meant you had to be out there looking pretty consistently. And that's what Caroline was doing, was spending hours sweeping, they called it. William built her a special telescope so that she could sweep for comets.
And what was her like life as a, 18th century woman of science living this sort of, she was in the household of her brother, but she had her own identity as a scientist. What was that like? And, how is it portrayed in the play?
Well, how it's portrayed in the play is the playwright has given her the wonderful gift of willfulness, where every now and then you get this hint of, I had to darn 2 years' worth of socks for the entire family before I left. She works very hard, and she's, to fulfill the role of female and keeping house. So I think Jory was really skilled at giving her somewhat of a human frustration with that, especially when she really wanted to be stargazing, when she really wanted to be assisting William in other pursuits of astronomy and things.
She did correspond with other astronomers. And in fact, I believe there's a scene in the play where
there's a reference to her letters. And in fact, the character of Time asks her, you realize that gentleman, I'm not pulling his name out of my brain right now, but you realize that he's married, don't you? And she's, well, of course I do. I'm just writing to him about these discoveries. And so you do get a hint of her trying to get the pebble in the water to expand a little bit, that ripple to expand a little bit more outside of the very tight relationship that she has with her brother.
So, yeah, she corresponded at a professional level as well with other astronomers, looking to them for – there's at least one case where I think it's a comet and William is not there. And so
she's obligated to write that letter.
Right. She has to get confirmation from some other male astronomer, I suppose. And so a letter goes off to London and she gives – she says, please – confirm that this is what you see. Later in life, she did get a considerable recognition. After William's death, she was awarded a number of medals and honorary memberships in learned societies of various things. So she began to gain quite a bit of recognition, but very late in life.
How is the death of William treated in the play? I would think that would be a very sort of ambivalent thing because it would if this is the person she had been attached to, her whole life depended on him, it would be a momentous occasion, his death. At the same time, it would free her to have her own identity.
Well, the playwright constructs that, I think, brilliantly. Of course, I think that because I love this play. But she actually has a scene early on with Mary, between Mary and Caroline, where the divide between them is immense. And Mary works very hard at trying to befriend. And, she announces that she's with child and says, would you move back into the house? And I could use, she reaches out her hand to Caroline. I could use the companionship. And I don't know how to do this. And it would be nice to have you. And Caroline, no, we'll have none of that. She's very, not rude, very polite and kind about it, but not interested in connecting. But then the playwright brings them back together after William's death. And the exchange between them and the gratitude that Mary expresses to Caroline for being such an important person in William's life, of course, but also in their son John's life. It's very heartfelt and deeply moving. And in fact, there's a passage there towards the end where Caroline is talking to Mary And Mary has asked her how engaged she will still be with John and with the two of them. And Caroline says, through my adult life, I was certain that I would die first. It did not matter that he was 12 years older than myself. His life was more valuable. It seemed natural that he should outlive me. I had a will, but it was done with belief that William would survive me. It is useless now. I also had a long letter to him that he would receive after my death. There are things unsaid between us. He did not read my last letter. And then Mary says to her, I am certain he knew whatever it was that you wanted to say to him. And then she realizes that she hasn't given her any consolation in his passing. So Caroline stops and says, I've been caught up in my own grief and so inconsiderate to yours. How can I help you? And then the scene goes on. So it's not just that they're connected there towards the end, but they are almost embraced as sisters. It's a very nice way that Jory has handled that relationship, and it really comes out after William's death.
And she points out that they now have John in common.
Yes.
And that continues not in the play, but in fact, as the history, that continues to be a very important relationship for all of them.
So what makes them the inventors of modern astronomy? I mean, it's one thing to find, you know, some comets, and another, of course, spectacular, to find this planet. But what makes them, William and Caroline Herschel, the founders of modern astronomy?
Well, it would be in a couple of respects. One is that William is turning descriptive astronomy into a science, which is to say he's not doing positional astronomy, as we mentioned. He's looking at, for example, these nebulae that we mentioned and attempting to derive from their appearance something about their nature. So it's an attempt to draw some conclusions from a very descriptive, from a very qualitative kind of approach. At the same time, he's also the pioneer of the most highly quantitative astronomy at the statistical level, this idea of sampling the sky, of attempting to perform a census, a star count, around what he assumed to be a representative portion of the sky, and then to extrapolate that to an understanding of the structure, overall structure of the Milky Way. So I think it's primarily in those two respects. On the one hand, the descriptive, that requires then a large telescope. That goes back to those large telescopes. But the statistical approach is unique. The vision that he had, that by making appropriate observations, he could extrapolate this to a discussion of the structure of the universe is unique.
What do you think the sort of important final lessons are about the story of William and Caroline Herschel, or what strikes you personally about these two?
I think of the lessons. I think about their lives, the scientific evidence of their lives. And the play, I think, share the common lessons of, and I think we talked a little bit about this earlier, of in the pursuit of something and the pursuit of something outside yourself, how you are included in that pursuit and what that means and how you are made up. And Jory, the playwright, has really gone through and grappled with that as Caroline grapples continually, wondering how she fits in to this. And I think it would be awfully confusing as a female in this time period specifically, but trying to figure out how your role is validated and how you can continue and succeed. And it didn't mean with power or prestige or recognition, but in discovery for her. And I think that that was so uncommon with women in this period of time especially, that she grappled with that completely. And towards the end of the play, Caroline is asking time. You know, she reflects on her brother first, talking about how William Herschel, lover of luminous beings, dreamer of origins, thinker, traveler, musician, father, husband, my brother. She goes through and talks about how he will be remembered and revered. And then she turns to the character of time and says, how many more nights of stargazing are allowed in me in my life? Each time I sweep the heavens, I can't believe the glory of the gift of life. I am a small person. How is it possible that I should be part of the enormity of the universe? How much time is allowed me before this dream ceases? Even at the end of this play, she is still grappling with this as a dream. And, you know, whether there's a in the sense of how is the reality of her life and the pursuit of this. She still grapples with that. And so I think one of the lessons to take away from this is confidence in what you're able to pursue. But beyond confidence, enjoyment. Revel in it. In the play, you never really know if Caroline ever thoroughly just reveled in the gift that she was giving science as well. And that's somewhat sad.
She seems truly excited at the character in the play,
mm-hmm.
at these moments of, well, the playwright keeps going back to this moment of discovery of a comet, which mm-hmm. is the thing that gives her something that's uniquely hers.
Yes.
In fact, there's a passage in there about how the name, even though Caroline won't have children.
Yes.
But the comets named after her are, mm-hmm. are like her children.
That's a good metaphor. This has been a combination of art and science this hour. The name of the play you've heard us refer to is Comet Hunter. It's by Chiori Miyagawa, and it's about William and Caroline Herschel, brother and sister astronomers who get credit for discovering the planet Uranus and many other discoveries as well. And our guests have been UW astronomer Jim Lattice, harpsichordist John Chapel Stowe, who plays some of the music of William Herschel, and also we've had with us during this hour Miranda McClenaghan, who recently directed that play, Comet Hunter. Thanks one and all for swimming into our ken for this hour.
Thank you very much.
Most welcome.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach. I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.